Hi, podcast listeners. Prashant here. Today, I'm speaking with Angel Diaz, counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. Angel works on some interesting issues that touch both technology and online content platforms. I pick his brain on technology's role in policing, online content moderation, and the role the government could play in regulating tech. Angel also shares some advice about what investors and operators should be aware of when building new technology or a content platform. Hope you enjoy. Hey, Angel, how's it going?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I am well. How are things in New York?
Oh, you know, can't complain. It's starting to be spring. It's probably going to be full of hot garbage soon.
All right. Sounds good. Well, I thank you again for joining us on the podcast. I know we've been trying to schedule this for a few months, but I'm happy to have you on to chat about some of the, yeah, absolutely. Happy to, you know, I want to chat about some of the topics that I know are you know, you're passionate about and that you're working on at the Brennan Center. So, you know, why don't you go ahead and do an introduction for yourself, and then we can jump into some of the topics.
Sure. So I'm counsel to the Liberty and National Security Program here at the Brennan Center. And my work focuses at the intersection of civil liberties and civil rights. And that sort of takes on two forms. One of the issues that I'm really active on is policing and technology. And the other bucket of work relates to online speech and content moderation.
Got it. And when you say tech in policing or other technology behind policing, can you elaborate on what that means? Because it's probably not obvious to people what that's referring to.
Yeah. So the police, and you know, a lot of my work is focused on New York City in particular, but police across the country have sort of a dizzying array of technologies that are available to them. So for example, a lot of police departments have access to facial recognition software. They engage in social media monitoring. They have Stingray devices that can trick your cell phone into connecting to the device instead of to a local cell tower. And by and large, most of these systems are purchased and used without any public knowledge or any public oversight into the fact that they're being used. And while a lot of these systems sound useful or maybe even cool to some people, they sort of have a lot of potentials for bias and potentials for sort of automating a lot of the inequalities that have caused policing to sort of disparately impact minority communities and particularly Black and Brown communities. So a lot of the work that we do is trying to increase transparency into police use of these technologies and sort of be able to sort of have the public hold their own police departments accountable.
A question I have is around what would be an ideal world for you? Like, is it no technology used in policing? Probably not that. You're not that extremist. But you obviously want to have a process and a measured way to deploy technology in policing. So what would that look like in an ideal world for you?
So I think a logical first step is just to sort of introduce better transparency into policing generally. So across the country, various cities are introducing legislation at the city council level that say, hey, police departments, we're not saying you can't use technology, but at the very least, you should be able to sort of give us a list of what's being used, how it works, and what sort of protections you have in place to protect the privacy of our citizens. And I think that sort of common sense transparency is a useful way for the public to have a better understanding of what's being used and what kind of technology is being used to surveil their fellow citizens. From there, I think that there actually are going to be situations where communities can decide for themselves what kinds of technology they do or do not want to use. So a good example of that is in San Francisco and in Oakland and in Somerville in Massachusetts. They are all considering potential moratoriums or bans on the use of facial recognition technology. These are all cities that have already passed sort of the oversight legislation that allows their citizens to have a better sense of what technology is being used in their communities. So one of the things that we're working on here in New York is passing a comparable sort of law that's called the POST Act here, and that stands for public oversight of surveillance technology. And what that bill would do would be is that it would allow or it would require the police department to kind of on an annual basis and on an ongoing basis create a list of all the technologies that it's using, how they generally work, and sort of an issue an impact and use statement where it would sort of detail some of the privacy protections that it has in place. I think it's worth making clear that when we're talking about transparency, we're not necessarily asking for operational details. The bill would not require the police to tell us, oh, well, we use it in this kind of investigation. We tend to place it in this part of town. It's more of a general oversight so that we can kind of have a better sense of how technology is being used and sort of be able to hold the police department accountable.
Do you think that transparency solves the problem of, you know, automating inequalities or the, you know, issues around consent or the natural bias? I'm playing this forward and thinking, okay, like let's imagine Angel is arguing for more disclosure, more transparency around any of these technologies to have citizens have a choice, right? Right now you're saying it's in the dark, they don't have a choice. Even if they do have a choice though, and let's say, you know, for a simple example, like it's a majority rule and they choose to deploy some technology, the tech itself could still perpetuate bias, couldn't it?
Yeah, it certainly can. And I think that the connection between transparency and what's going on in San Francisco and in Oakland kind of show the logical next step, which is once communities are empowered to understand how these technologies are being used and how they work more broadly, they're empowered to take the logical next step, which is to say there are certain kinds of technologies that are either don't work or are too littered with bias to be effectively deployed. For example, predictive policing is a popular technology that's used by numerous police departments across the country. How it generally works is that it takes information based on historical crime data and it tries to predict likely hotspots for crime. And this will sort of help the police department say, oh, it looks like in the past there's been a lot of crimes reported here, here, and here, so let's send more police officers to those areas. What researchers have sort of found is that predictive policing doesn't often predict crime, it just predicts policing. It predicts where cops have gone generally. And what we know from history is that police departments have often engaged in a lot of unconstitutional policing tactics like stop and frisk. And so a lot of departments are now under court supervision because of these unconstitutional practices. But at the same time, we're still using that same historical data to inform an algorithm. And then the algorithm is going to essentially perpetuate that same practice that we've already decided is illegal and sort of launder it through a technological system. So these are the kinds of issues where perhaps it may be the case that if we're going to use predictive policing, it cannot rely on historical data that is irredeemably tainted by unconstitutional policing.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, that gets to something I was going to ask about before you said it, which is this a problem of inputs, right? Like bad in, bad out, or is it also maybe an issue of the people who are building it, right? I know that a lot of technology, not just limited to stuff that is used by police or the criminal justice system, you know, is influenced obviously by the people who design it and code it, right? And there's a lot of institutional biases that are built in by that. So is this kind of a multi-pronged problem where not only is the historical data and the empirical data that people are relying on dirty in quote unquote and it's bad to use, but there's also like who are the people building these things and are they aware of all the unknown consequences of what they may be building?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. The part of it is the data that's being input and the other part of it is sort of how the system itself is being deployed. And I think that oftentimes folks sort of say, oh, well, you know what, we're not going to take race into consideration. And because it's not a factor, they think that they've eliminated the racial bias. And I think that an understanding of the ways in which any number of approximations for race can sort of perpetuate the same problems can still find their way into systems. And so you're right that, you know, an evaluation of minimizing bias is going to require a whole set of evaluations beyond just the D-inputs. And one of the big issues around this area, and I'm sure you guys are familiar with this, is just that a lot of these are sort of created by businesses who have, you know, legitimate IP concerns around not wanting to share the secret sauce that, that powers their algorithm. At the same time, I think it's we're sort of due for a conversation about if you're going to make your systems available to impact, you know, government welfare and well-being, you will maybe have to sort of be open to the idea that a third party will have to be able to audit your system to find bias and to sort of teeter that out and to have those audits sort of be an ongoing reality. Because as you and I know, you know, an algorithm is changed regularly. And so something that was tested a year ago before you bought it is going to sort of been changed over time. And as you're sort of deploying more sophisticated systems, they may actually be learning to arrive at disparate at outcomes that are biased, even if they were not necessarily programmed into it on purpose. Machines are very quick to learn some of the darker parts of our own humanity. And so there needs to be a way to supervise outputs from perpetuating biases.
Got it. I want to shift gears a little bit to talk about, you know, the second area that you mentioned you focused on around, you know, online content, moderation and policing that content. How do you, you know, let's first of all, let's frame it. Like, can you frame the balance or the issues at stake here when we talk about that broad topic?
Yeah. So the question of content moderation is a big one. And I think that ultimately what folks are really concerned about right now is the extent to which hate speech, voter misinformation, you know, misinformation about vaccines are sort of proliferating on the online platforms. And what is the role of social media companies in sort of taking that content down and potentially also thinking about what's their role in amplifying those kinds of viewpoints. And our work here at the Brennan Center focuses on trying to keep in mind the values of free speech and the importance of having a sort of platform for robust sort of conversations around topics in the public interest, even if some of those ideas are unpopular or potentially harmful. And that is something that I think is going to be oftentimes missing as we're sort of rushing to have a fix for an issue as sort of hard hitting and in the news as sort of hate speech and terrorist content. Express yourself.
So would it be your position then that you're in favor of kind of the least policing on platforms by the platforms themselves as possible?
No, I don't think so. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, it's worth making clear that, you know, the First Amendment doesn't apply to online platforms. So the restrictions around hate speech that Facebook or Twitter or YouTube has is much stronger than would be allowed for a government regulation to say. And right. So I'm not saying that they shouldn't do it. I think that what we really need better information on is how well they're doing and who's getting removed, why they're being removed, if there's actually an avenue to appeal those decisions. And I think that in particular, as there's more and more pressure from government and from various members of society to say, hey, take down more content and take it down faster, they're increasing their reliance on automated tools that oftentimes miss context and end up sort of, again, sort of automating a lot of these inequalities that sort of disparately impact minority communities. So we have activists that are sort of saying, hey, here's this piece of content that was abusive toward me, or was sort of hate speech directed towards me. And rather than go after that perpetrator, the person that posted it to complain about it is being suspended or being taken off of the platform. And so we need to understand that these tools that are being deployed are quite clunky and actually may make things worse. And so we need a better way to understand what's being taken down and why. And so I think that the question of transparency is often sort of lost in our rush to just demand for greater and greater content removals.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. And, you know, in a world where platforms like Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, and you can go down the list, they have to do some form of moderation, of course, right? Like obvious things like threats, death threats, things like that, those have to be removed, right? Like graphic content is obviously banned by some of these platforms. Those need to be removed. But at the end of the day, a lot of this is still going to be subjective and it's not going to be set in stone. Like you said, algorithms change. When you were talking about technology and policing, like these rules of engagement and what's okay and what's not on a platform change all the time. And what somebody views subjectively as, you know, meeting one of those thresholds could be different than what somebody else views. So are you comfortable with, even if there's transparency, the platforms being in charge of self-regulating basically? Or do you think that there's a role for the government to play, not just in transparency and saying, disclose the rules, disclose how you're making these decisions, but actually take steps to define what is and isn't okay?
Yeah. So no, I don't. I think that in particular, when it comes to speech regulation, there's just a real danger that government action sort of quickly moves closer and closer to censorship. So to give you an example of this, oftentimes law enforcement will sort of direct a go to a platform and say, hey, there's this piece of content here that is hate speech. You should remove it. And it's hate speech under the terms of service of the platform. However, under the law of that given country, they wouldn't be allowed to remove that content for being hate speech. And so what's going on is that governments are already sort of laundering their sort of their content takedown requests and going and being able to reach a larger swath of content than they would be able to do under their own laws. And that's sort of troubling because there's none of the attendant protections that we would normally have in terms of being able to challenge that action in court, to be able to have a judge sort of review it and decide whether that actually was protected speech under the laws of a given country. Mm-hmm. And so what we're creating is this sort of secret level of censorship that is going to sort of not have a lot of the due process protections that we expect to have in sort of normal Western democracies.
Right. You're, and you know, at the crux of what you're saying, or the position at least I'm hearing is, you know, the risk that there's a backdoor for censorship by the government is that outweighs, you know, the risk we run of allowing controversial ideas. You know, I'm using a euphemistic term. Some ideas can be, you know, probably more hateful than just controversial. But basically, you have to balance this like we do a lot of things in society, right? And we just have to be really careful about a backdoor for kinds of censorship, from especially the government.
Yeah, and to put a finer point on it, we do need some breathing room for controversial ideas to sort of develop over time. You know, we're not so far removed from the idea that, you know, gay marriage was considered probably an obscenity to a lot of people, or the idea that interracial marriage was an acceptable idea in American society. There needs to be some breathing room for ideas that are just largely sort of unacceptable to most Americans to have space to sort of incubate so that we can return to them later on down the line. It doesn't always have to be this idea of racism or hatred. And on the other side, I think it's worth keeping in mind that even if we remove larger and larger swaths of hate speech, you know, racism is a reality of America and it's existed before the internet and it's likely going to continue through various iterations of the internet. So In terms of being able to eradicate an ideology, I think that it's tempting to sort of think that we'll be able to deplatform racism, when in reality, racism is it's too embedded in a lot of our American ideologies to really be able to do that.
Got it. And so is it fair then to think that you would characterize kind of the New York Times and it being responsible for the content and the journalism that it's putting out as different than holding Facebook responsible for what you or I might post on our Facebook profile?
So I think in the context of the First Amendment, they're very similar. So there's a very there's a big case called New York Times versus Sullivan, and this grew out of the civil rights era. And a group of civil rights activists bought an ad that criticized various government officials in Alabama for their mistreatment of civil rights protesters. And a government official sued the New York Times and said for defamation. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument and said that there needs to be some breathing room for the First Amendment, for free debate. And sometimes the attacks that people will issue will be harsh and may actually even harm the reputation of public officials. And they may sometimes even have statements that aren't 100% accurate. And that sort of is to be expected, and that we can't sort of have such a tight lid over free discourse that we don't allow people to really be uninhibited and sort of be able to discuss issues that are in the public interest. And I think that that same sort of framework is what is applied to online platforms, and that there needs to be some wiggle room. And if the New York Times was to be held responsible for every single claim that was made by the person purchasing an editorial ad, they may decide that they just don't want to carry ads entirely. And you can make the same argument in terms of imposing too much liability onto content platforms may just push them to just remove more and more controversial ideas because they don't want to be held to a particular standard.
I see what you're saying. You don't want to create the wrong incentive structure, which can end up in a worse place than you originally intended anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, let's talk about government regulation of quote-unquote tech or technology or big tech, you know, separate from the conversation we were just having around policing content and whether or not the government should step in on that. Just more broadly, you know, obviously some, you know, presidential candidates have called for breaking up big tech, whatever that means, right? And others have talked about more specific regulations around, you know, privacy notices. This came up in the Facebook hearings with Mark Zuckerberg, right? Or notice and consent. And some have talked about kind of what data is okay to use and how much do you have to disclose and how can it be used? How can it be used? You know, do you think that there's a place for government regulation of kind of the uses of inputs or outputs or how big you can get? You know, what's your kind of take on this kind of growing idea that, or at least the growing discourse that we're hearing around this idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think that outside of the content moderation space, there are a lot of interesting questions around how do we hold the use of technology accountable and sort of make sure that it's actually complying with a lot of the rules that we have around civil rights. So a good example of that would be the settlement that Facebook recently entered into with the ACLU over their advertising policy or their advertising platform, which allowed people to sort of target particular kinds of ads related to employment or housing or credit to some races, but not to others. I think, you know, these are logical extensions of existing rules. And I think that there's a real opportunity for civil rights laws to ensure that platforms are not creating tools that allow advertisers to sort of discriminate on the basis of race when it comes to really important basic services, like where someone's going to live, where they're going to work, and whether they're able to get a credit to buy a home or to, you know, be able to buy a car to take to work. There are opportunities like that where I think it makes a lot of sense. Here in New York City, we have an algorithmic transparency task force that was assembled to sort of look at all the different ways in which technology is being used to sort of inform agencies' decision-making processes. And as a result of that report, ideally they're going to have a list of recommendations that say, hey, there maybe we should establish a way for a citizen to challenge a decision that was rendered by a machine that might impact where their kid is matched to go to school, where a new firehouse is going to be built, whether or not someone's considered a risk for purposes of being out on bail. You know, these are sort of fundamental freedoms that I think are going to have to be reevaluated when the decisions are being either replaced or largely aided by the use of technology. And those sorts of laws are sort of probably being kicked around right now, and we haven't seen too many of them yet, but they are going to sort of have to be ways in which we grapple with the reality of machine learning sort of generally coming to inform a lot more of how government carries on its day-to-day functions.
What role do you think the government or local, more, you know, the federal or more local governments should play in the world of emerging technologies like autonomous vehicles, right? Or things beyond that as well, virtual reality, augmented reality. Like, is there stuff that the government should be doing now that it's not? And what other markets could you see facing regulation, you know, coming in the future?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that one of the popular examples of this relates to facial recognition, right? So it's tempting to say, hey, we want to be able to find a dangerous person, and wouldn't it be great if we had sort of an ability to sort of quickly identify them based on their face and see where they are in a given city. I think that oftentimes there needs to be a greater role in government to sort of actually take a step back and think about the system that they're purchasing and whether it actually works. So a good example of that would be that New York City is running a pilot program here where they deployed facial recognition cameras at some of the bridges and tunnels into New York City. They wanted to be able to scan the faces of drivers as they came into Manhattan. And perhaps unsurprisingly, the test result didn't return any useful pictures. So basically the entire system was kind of a failure. And nonetheless, the policy, the pilot program is sort of still going on, and it's going to continue to sort of gobble up data. So I think that there is a role of government to think about what it is that it's deploying and sort of what are some of the downstream consequences. We also know, you mentioned autonomous vehicles, that a lot of the sort of systems that are analyzing different sort of people, they have a hard time when it comes to identifying women, and they have a hard time when it comes to identifying women of color in particular. So what does this mean? It means that if you are deploying, you eventually deploy a system that has fully autonomous vehicles moving around the streets, women of color are more at risk of being hit by autonomous vehicles than someone like you or me. And that raises a lot of serious issues. And there is a role for government to sort of ensure that those kinds of risks are being minimized in a very real way, rather than just deploying it and hoping that we'll be able to sort of get the kinks figured out later on down the line.
Got it. Makes sense. What are you kind of most afraid of? I know you focus on the two areas we covered, but what are you most afraid of happening kind of 10 years, 25 years from now? We spent a little bit of time talking about in an ideal world for Angel, what would things look like? What's your kind of, what would be the worst outcome for you in like 10 or 25 years?
You know, I think that what I'm most worried about is that we're going to deploy systems that people think are not biased and that they're neutral because they're sort of run by machines and not by people, and that they actually will sort of end up really harming vulnerable communities, but that there won't be an avenue to sort of challenge it because it's going to say, oh, well, it wasn't done by a person, it was done by a machine. And that we actually may end up deploying algorithmic technology to sort of do everything from deepen the over-policing of minority communities to create new structures for gentrification or the displacement of minority communities to having sort of systems in place that create segregated schools and justify them under the use of an algorithm that, you know, basically take your pick of civil right harm that's existed in the past. And we have a very real possibility that the use of machines may obscure the fact that we're sort of operating at a much larger scale when it comes to perpetuating those inequalities. And I think that on the content moderation side, I really worry that we'll get to a place where it basically becomes impossible to have an opinion online that criticizes a government or that is outside of the mainstream, what that actually may mean for the development of various different countries' ability to push forward new ideas and to sort of question infrastructures of power.
Makes sense. So, I mean, you know, I work at a VC fund. You know, what advice would you offer, not just me, but kind of the general tech community or venture capital investors around some of the stuff that you work on day to day? You know, we see and invest in businesses that are content businesses, right? We invest in businesses that are building algorithms that could potentially be deployed in, you know, government or policing situations. So, you know, what advice would you give to people? What should they be wary of? What should they look for? How should they think about the technology and the people building those companies?
Yeah. So I think that there are actually three sort of easy ways that companies can think about how to mitigate some of the potentials for automating inequality. I think the first one is to hire as diversely as they can and to think about incorporating different viewpoints to sort of catch a lot of issues that maybe the average engineer may miss. The second is just try to develop autonomy mechanisms along the way and to be able to sort of evaluate their systems, not only for, you know, the ordinary bugs that everybody looks for, but some of the results that are going to potentially be biased against particular communities. And I think the third would likely be to sort of consider the way in which they sort of deploy confidentiality with government, and to think about ways in which, you know, I understand that there's a need to protect intellectual property, but there also needs to be a way for government agents or a third party auditor to be able to sort of evaluate your technology and decide whether or not it's sufficiently protective of civil rights and civil liberties to be deployed by a government system.
Makes sense. You know, this has been a great conversation. I'm glad you were on the podcast. And it was at least interesting for me to learn about some of the stuff that you're working on and your points of view on some of these topics, which are nuanced and not easy. And society will continue to grapple with it as technology becomes a bigger part of every dimension of our life, including government and policing. And as platforms like a Facebook become more and more important and part of our social fabric, it's going to be even more important to think about things like the Fourth Amendment and free speech and how we think about moderation.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.